How long is this going to be?
Probably it's usually around 30 minutes. Just depends on, how long your answers are. But
Like 4 hours.
usually about 30 minutes.
We like to stick with yes or no. That's it. Like
It should be about 2 minutes long then. Hey everybody, Brian Collins here with another episode of the Pixel Hub podcast. Of course, I can't do the podcast alone. I've got to have my best buddy in the world, Dan Lefebvre, sitting over there. And I know he's excited today because we're going to be talking about tabletop games, board games, and he loves them.
Oh yeah, it's been looking to talk to somebody about board games for a while, so really excited about this one.
Yeah, we finally caught up with Grant Wilson and Mike Ritchie. They work for, they have a studio called Rather Dashing Games, and they make board games.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we're going to talk to them. Mike is the game designer, and Grant is the art director. So you've got, two guys who are basically filling both, or all the parts of what you need, the visual and the mechanics side of the game. So it'll be interesting to see how that process works, and maybe how it compares to something like, say, creating a video game with the pipeline.
Yeah, that's something I'm really looking forward to hearing from them, is because just from my own background, I'm more familiar with the creation process of video games.
Yeah.
So I'll apologize in advance if I kind of use that term, but I'm just more familiar with that pipeline. So it'll be really interesting. I'm looking forward to hearing kind of how they work and how they work together and how they create their board games. And
I'm expecting them to be expecting there to be a lot of crossover.
Oh, I'm sure.
Because, creating a game sort of has some foundational elements that exist across any medium,
well,
I think.
Kind of like what you just mentioned, right? I mean, you're going to have the gameplay mechanics. You're going to have the art.
Yeah.
I mean, you have game designers in video games, just and Mike Ritchie, you have art directors in video games. And so, yeah, there's going to be a lot of overlap, I would expect, but I'm excited to hear kind of some of the more specifics on that and hear how they make their games.
I'm excited, too. Well, let's get after it. So, without further ado, here is Grant Wilson and Mike Ritchie. So, Grant and Mike, we thought we'd start off with you guys just telling us, how did you get into making board games, tabletop games, and what you did previously?
Okay, we'll start with Mike since he's been doing it longer.
Oh, sure. I've been designing games forever, just usually modifications for, existing role-playing games or tabletop stuff we were doing as, kids and teenagers. Mm-hmm. And then eventually I had some of my designs, and I looked at it and I was like, this is actually pretty good. I think I could do this. And fortunately, my wife agreed.
After some persuasion.
Yeah. So I had some prototypes and I went to Toy Fair in New York. Mm-hmm. And I ended up connecting with a company that distributed games from Europe but didn't have any of their own properties. Mm-hmm. So I designed games for them for, 7 or 8 years and got some really good feathers in my cap, and I've always wanted to do my own thing. And so that was where Grant entered in.
Yeah, I mean, I've been a gamer my whole life, too. Mike and I've known Mike since I was 5. And
you're admitting that on...
didn't say I liked you.
Knew of you, right?
Yeah, we're basically a hive mind of a game designer and artist. And, Mike designs the core of the games. I do the art. And we overlap a little bit, and so we have this high mind. And so when Mike was working with another company, he was doing really well. He just like, I just want to have the freedom to go on my own. I'm like, well, what's stopping you? He says, well, a little bit of capital and a good artist, because it's expensive. And I'm like, hey, dude, we had a V8 moment, slapped our forehead. And so we've been going ever since, yeah.
So what are some examples of some of the games, Mike, that you were designing early on with that company?
Oh, they had a lot of people that owned the company were really much into action sports, which I am not, but I find it interesting as a true gamer. So I ended up, after I designed a few kind of geekier titles for them, I ended up getting commissioned by them and their connections at X Games to do a custom skateboarding game for the upcoming X Games that year.
Okay.
And so they fly me out to Van Skate Park in California. I sit there for a week taking notes, and it was a crazy eye opener. And after that, that got some notoriety. And then Barnes & Noble's like, hey, we need a Halloween game this year. Could you guys do it? And then So I started just doing these custom projects for various, you know, high level clients.
It's funny because, Mike will sit there and just be like, anything. Like, my wife sells essential oils, these, super healthy stuff. And she's talking to Mike about it for about 15 minutes. And he turns to me, he's like, I've got a game. So, like, every time he's got it's crazy. You just,
is it sort of like a habit, Mike? You just sort of see them like
I feel like a guitar player who's always going around plucking at riffs. Like, I've got all these little bits of games just floating around in my head, and every once in a while one will lock into a theme, or just like Grant says, the V8 moments. Mm-hmm. And then I will put them together, and my wife is the first line of defense, so 90% of them never see them on the day.
Yeah, it's funny because he'll come up to me and he'll spit all these mechanics and math and stuff, mm-hmm. like, you know, and the whole time I'm thinking theme and feel. Uh-huh. And, you know, we start having these conversations, and our wives just sit there scratching their heads because we haven't said a single noun in 20 minutes. Oh, yeah, do it. And we know exactly where we are. And it's just funny. Stuff like that.
So as far as timeline goes, when did you guys start Rather Dashing Games?
We started about 4 years ago.
Yeah, about that.
Right. But we haven't really pushed it hard until like the last year.
Yeah, our lives opened up to the point where we can say, okay, we can really tackle this the way we want to.
And the growth has been great. The reception has been fantastic. We specialize in games that are less than 5 minutes to learn, less than an hour to play, and lighter stuff, but still rich and high replay value. People love it. It's incredible. We'll go to Gen Con and stuff like this, these big board game conventions, and the number of people who actually stop and look at our games and compared to the number of people who actually buy them is really, really high, you know, which is pretty rare. You know, a lot of people, it's like at the most 50%. We got probably about 90%.
Oh, wow.
Oh, wow, that is good. So do you guys have any particular, I guess you'd call them genres or whatever. Like, do you stick with, card games, or do you use dice, or do you use, figures or something like that?
We're open to all different kinds of components. Our games do have lots of different components, but we try to keep them themed to a point where they're approachable by families.
Okay.
But still, the hardline gamers go by, and to them, it's a lighter game, but they still have a chuckle and they enjoy playing it. So our themes tend to be on the geekier side. You know, we have a game called Dwarven Miner. We have a game called Pirates, Ninjas, Robots, and Zombies. So we definitely go with the more pop, geeky stuff. But we're kind of open to anything.
Yeah, we're not limited so much by, you know, the style of, like, the actual mechanics of the game as much as approachability.
So our audience is made up of a lot of different artists, and a lot of them are in games. And I would probably venture to say most of them are in video games and may not be familiar with the process of creating a board game. Can you kind of walk us through maybe a stereotypical process of, like, the pipeline for creating a board game?
Sure. Typically, we either start with, boy, it'd be cool to have a game about dwarves, or you start with, here's a cool mechanic, we don't know what world to put it in. Mm-hmm. And so usually Mike will have, he'll work the game mechanics out in his head, and then I'll draw up some quick art, placeholder art, so that it makes sense, and we get a sense of how it looks, and then we just start playing it. And about 2 minutes into the first game, every time we're like, all right, we know what we need to fix.
Yeah.
And we go back and fix it. And you want
to? Yeah, sure. And then it just hones back and forth. Each time we play, there's fewer and fewer changes to make. Usually there's a couple bottles of Tylenol, at least on my end. And once we've got something that us, our wives, and a couple close friends really enjoy, we're like, okay, this is good. We'll open it up to a larger playtesting audience, colleagues and friends, people we know we can trust, get some decent feedback, which we always get good feedback. And while that is going on, because even though the game's not done, we know we're at a point where it can be done. Mm-hmm. And that's usually when we're really honing in on what's the artwork going to be. Grant's in his art cave, you know, drawing away.
Yeah, right. Son, what's that? Yeah.
Oh, I know how that is.
And then we like to have the game to a point where we really like it and we think it's done. And then we shelve it for a little bit. Hmm. And then a month or two later, we'll pull it down and go play it again and go, oh my gosh, no, why did we stop here? Or more often than not, we're like, yeah, it's still good.
Yeah, it's still good, or just one tiny tweak because one of us thought of it over the last month. But we found that shelving a game, we actually wrote an article on this in a trade magazine, is that designers need to shelve their games and not rush them to production for that reason, because the fresh eyes approach has helped us invaluably.
Well, yeah, I mean, I work in video games too, and there's definitely alpha testing, beta testing. And then, you know, one of the quotes we live and die by is Miyamoto's, a bad game, a late game is late until it's out, and a bad game is bad forever.
So. Yep. Not that we try to be late, but it happens.
So with these play tests that you do, I'm always fascinated by that because I assume that the feedback is sort of, the quality of the feedback is really dependent upon the quality of the questions that ask. You know what I mean? And so do you guys, how much design do you go into creating a test or a questionnaire? Or do you just, in these instances with your friends and family, do you just sort of watch them and then have them talk to you?
I tend to watch a lot. People will be like, don't you want to play? I'm like, nope, I've designed it. I want to sit back and I want to watch everybody play. I want to see their interactions. Mm-hmm. I want to see where the aha moments are, where the laughter is, where there's any confusion. And typically we ask questions, but we don't really need like questionnaires or anything because our play testers are very, they're pros themselves in a lot of cases.
Well, and the biggest test for a board game is giving them the game and giving them the rules and not being there, like watching them play. Like, did the rules explain the game enough? Which is something you don't really come across in the video game world as much, but you know, your rules have to be clear. They have to be able to read it and play the game right.
And it's hard to write. It's not necessarily hard to write rules. It's hard to write rules that fit onto one page and make sense to everyone.
Yeah,
exactly right. So do you guys have like a limit of, all right, so you have like people, they sit down, they read the rules, you're watching them, and then they start the game. And do you have a time limit of, okay, it took them 20 minutes to sort of figure it out, but that's too long?
Yeah, like we said, we want our games to be learned, depending on the game, but typically in less than 5 minutes.
Okay, yeah, you said that. All right.
But, you know, some people are sharper than others. So, you know, you go 5 to 10. If they don't figure it out by then, then there's something wrong. And,
Well, the thing, too, is I also like to think is, like, how often in that first game you always – every time I play a tabletop game, I'll probably reference the rules once or twice, you know, the first play or two. I try to watch how many times do they do that. If they just had a quick question like, oh, what's this do again? They glance at the rules and get it. Like, all right, these rules are pretty clear.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, we also, it's funny, we'll be like, hey, play the game once, give us, you know, and then we want feedback. And what's nice is every single time with every one of our games is like, no, we want to play it again.
We're going to keep playing.
Yeah. Keep playing. It's like, all right, that's a good sign.
Yeah, it's always a good sign. Something that's really interesting to me, especially with board games that I've played, there's a huge social aspect to it. So it's not just about the game that you're playing, but it's also about the experience of interacting with the people around you. When you're doing your play tests and when you're designing the game, how much or how do you factor that aspect into how the game is designed?
Oh, that's a huge factor, especially, you know, it depends on what kind of game you're designing. You know, like we want our games to be what they call beer and pretzel games, kind of, where you sit down with your friends, you want something light, you can converse while you're playing. It doesn't take so much focus. And that's key. A lot of the times, you know, Mike's original mechanic will have, it'll be great and it'll be awesome, but almost always we're like, okay, how are people interacting? Do I feel like I'm playing solitaire with four other people? That's not fun, you know?
Yeah.
And we notice a lot of games that do that, and we specifically avoid games where someone is eliminated and sits and watches the rest of the game. That is boring to us. But yeah, you definitely want to have a social experience. And then when we go to these board game conventions and introduce these games for the first time to the general public, You know, you watch him sit down, you watch him play it, and you're waiting. And then, like, round three, somebody, like, smashes the table and goes, oh! And then, you know, you did it right, because that's what you're going for.
Yeah, a rage flip is the best compliment. So the social experience is the point of a board game.
Right.
And if I'm not, I only purchase games myself in my collection that obviously I end up buying some that I, you know, made a bad judgment call on, but I look for ones that I know the people I play with are going to walk away and be talking about a couple days later.
Yeah. Right.
I was going to ask, do you factor in at any time, like, overly competitive players into the rules or whatever? Because I know we've all played with someone that's, like, you know, way too competitive. Do you factor in stuff like that to try and balance it?
Yeah. I mean, our games tend to really tick off the alpha gamers. Because we try to have – there's something in the board game industry called a runaway leader or also a kingmaker. And a runaway leader is, okay, you've got the first goal or whatever in the game, and now no one can catch you really no matter what. And the kingmaker is – let's say there's a four-player game, and I know I'm losing, but I can sabotage something so I know someone else will win or won't win. And we try to avoid those, and that's the kind of thing like those alpha gamers look for in a game to assert their alpha dominance.
They can't find their basement dominance. But, yeah, we had one guy that was playing one of our games, and he had played like a round, and he goes, well, what's to prevent me from doing X, Y, and Z? He said, nothing. Go ahead, try it. And, like, it won't work. And he's like, no, it'll work. And then he left and wrote a review of the game, a crappy review of the game. We're like, dude, you didn't even play it. And so we met him again a little bit later, and we're like, give it a shot. And it failed. And
just wiped, like, the walls with him.
Like, we know what we're doing, yeah.
So is there a form of cheating in your games? I mean, I know that's real prevalent in video games. Is that something that you almost have to if you find somebody has found a way around the rules, do you have to – I think once again, my mind is kind of thinking in video games because I haven't made board games, but do you have to issue a patch of some sort, like an update or anything like
that's
that?
That's the problem with board games is you can't do that. So that's why the test play is so heavy.
And the rule writing.
When we get together, we don't get together to play these games to win. We play to break them. So we're doing stupid, silly stuff to try to break the game. And that's what you look for in a good test player. You know this, like QA.
Now, my wife is great at it, and she'll do something completely absurd. And she's like, well, in the rules, I can do it. I'm like, crap.
Oh, yeah.
And at that point, we have to make the judgment, is this something we want to use in the game or not?
Yeah,
and want to cut it out. And we have a game coming up called Tanks for Playing, and it's just over the top, nuke each other with tanks. Just
very cartoony, Advanced War style art. You know?
Yeah, and you have just these simple powers that can be used very creatively. And every time we're playing it, someone's like, no way, like, can you do this? And we're like, oh, you shouldn't be able to do that. And we're like, no, wait, that's the whole point of the game.
Yeah, in this game, you should. But as to really answer the question, we haven't had to, like, issue a patch, so to speak, or anything like that yet. Doesn't mean it wouldn't happen in the future as we make more and more complex games. But usually the board game community, you've got your haters, like every community. Sure. Except video games. There's no haters in video games.
No.
There's always exceptions, right? I mean.
You get your haters here and there, but generally speaking, the board game community is very forgiving. And if you just post on your website, oh, here's a little bit of, here's an error we're correcting, and you put it around in social blogs, and there's places like Board Game Geek where you can post things like that, usually there's not an issue.
No, people don't care.
I would assume that some of this trying to break the game involves some kind of alcohol at some point.
No comment.
I was going to ask about physical considerations. You know, with a video game, you don't really have those. But for a tabletop game or something like that, you have to take those kind of considerations, right? Absolutely. You have to make those kind of.
Well, that starts day one too. It's sometimes frustrating as a more seasoned game designer now than I used to be, where it's like, when I started making games, I was just like, sure, we'll have, you know, 150 dice. We won't work. Now it's like, it factors in from day one. It's like, okay, we want to deliver this type of experience with these types of components at this price point. And you've got to balance those three things out.
Yeah. And Mike will be like, you know, I'll be someone will come up with an idea like, oh, what if we had this and this in the game? And I can see in his head him calculating the printing sheets.
Yeah.
You know, that pushes over to another sheet, which will take more money. How does, you know, it cost more money and all this. And this weird thing. And I mean, the video games, you got to worry about, you know, processor capacity and stuff like that. It's there, but it's different.
Yeah. Yeah.
Whereas we in the industry, we pay by the sheet, whether it's for, you know, thick tiles or for whether it's cards. Yeah. And the cards at a certain dimension, you can fit so many cards on a sheet. And so when we say, let's throw this in the game, I'm like, okay, we have room for four more cards and we're keeping the price the same. Or we change the size of the cards. Yeah. Or, you know, there's all these things you balance out.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that. What's your typical process for creating the actual pieces and the cards and that? Is that something that you will typically kind of prototype out first and when you're doing the playtesting to make sure that you have the right elements? Or what is that process like?
Yeah, we, you know, this is why the art's important early on, is that the game has to, we have to have the organizational elements of the game, like the UI or the HUD, you know, you've got to have these elements there so the information is displayed correctly, so you can gauge if there's a referencing issue or anything like that. And, you know, we'll print it on our home printers on cardstock, but it'll be the right size and everything like that, so we can get a sense of it. But, you know, we have a line of games called the Drawn and Quartered, which are all tiles. And we had to, you know, measure how tall they were to make sure the box was the right size and all this stuff. But yeah, when you prototype, you're trying to make it as much of the real game as possible, which is great because we have that hive mind with the art.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
so with the developer and the artist are so close, it's really, we may be one of the only teams like that in the industry.
And it's really refreshing for me as a designer, because a lot of artists are kind of, they may be a great artist, but they're a one trick pony. They do this kind of art and that's it. And I know a lot of them.
Yeah.
Brant is very versatile. And if you look at the line of games, each line like looks, has a very unique and very distinct art style. And once we decide what that art style is going to be, I kind of almost know in my head what I'm going to get. I'll call up Brant and say, I need a dwarven wizard. And be like, all right. Next day, his sketch comes over. I'm like, yeah, that's pretty much what I had in my head.
Yeah, he'll send me things like, yeah, a dwarven bardic war chanter. I'm like, I don't even know what that is.
Does that come with a definition too of what exactly that is?
No.
Yes and no. It doesn't. And then he asks for one, and then I out of my butt.
So you've referenced this idea of high mind. Which I think I understand through the context of what you're saying. Are you saying that you guys make an awesome pair because you represent both sides of the sort of creative process?
Yeah, it's interesting because, I remember calling up Mike with a game mechanic. I had, like a dream mechanic, we call it, where you had a dream about you wake up, right? And usually after about 15 minutes, it's crap. But, you know, as reality sets you, you're like, this isn't going to work. But, you know, every once in a while I'll have something like that. Like, Mike, here's a cool mechanic, and then he'll make it work, which I'm not the game designer. Or he'll have the mechanic and I'll help hone it.
Yeah.
And likewise with the art. Mike's a great designer, and he has a good eye for art. So I'll draw something and be like, you know, what if you did this or this different? And so, yeah, we're just like a hive mind. We're like, wherever I'm lacking, he excels and vice versa. And we've known each other our entire lives.
Yeah, it's like I can barely draw stick figures, but I can I designed deck plans to this airship we were using in a story we came up with. And I hand these deck plans over and they're just, you know, written, they're drawn pretty crappily on graph paper, but he makes this beautiful ship out of it. And so, yeah, it works really well.
And when you guys do your prototyping and you print off your cards or whatever at home and you see if it works, then how do you get like the pieces? Do you go to do you have a special supplier, or is it online supplier or local?
I have drawers and drawers of game pieces that I've accumulated over the years. Either I've cannibalized old games, which I did a lot when I was younger, or now that we're in the industry, we'll go to a warehouse. For one of our distributors, and we'll simply just go shopping like we're at Costco. I need red and blue dice. I need green meeples. I need card sleeves. And just load up the card.
But it really doesn't matter. You know, you print it on your printer, or you go to Staples and you get it. You know, you cannibalize an old game board, whatever. But when it comes to actually making the game, yeah, you talk to the printer, the manufacturer, you send them over everything. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they'll send you a white box, which is you know, everything built, kind of like a gray box in a video game. You built so you can see and make sure everything fits right. And yeah, they'll send over the sheets and you proof the prints and then they make it. You cross your fingers and they make it.
Yep. And then you have to deal with shipping across the ocean and dealing with port strikes and all that fun stuff.
That sounds like fun.
Right. And that's the thing, having physical inventory like this. I mean, I know video games have physical inventory, but it's, you know, you can fit a lot of them in a very small space.
Yeah.
The physical inventory with board gaming is always a challenge for managing your supply lines and your distribution channels.
Yeah. Yeah, well, even like I know like the big publishers and stuff will have physical, but you think of a lot of indie developers and such, they're just publishing to Steam. Or I mean, everything's pretty much digital at this point, so they don't have that consideration to even think about.
It's brilliant. The overhead costs are low, you know. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It allows talent to float to the top.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, one question I have, a lot of times when people think of, you know, a board game, they'll think of one of the classics like, you know, a Monopoly or Risk that just takes forever, right? Or it takes a long time. I mean, it's fun, but it takes a long time. But then your games, you're specifically trying to make them shorter experiences, but repetitive and wanting to play it over and over again because you have that social aspect. How do you, say if you go through the play test and you find that the game is playing too long, what are some ways that you can shorten that experience without destroying the experience?
Yeah, well, that's the question to answer. We had one game that was great. People loved it. And, you know, six people, there was no real limit to how many people could play it. But it kept slowing it down, the number of people. So we brought it back down to, you know, 2 to 4 player when you could pretty much do 2 to 6 with it.
Yeah.
And now everyone's like, how come you can't play, you know, 6 player in this? And we're like, well, Flip, you can, but it will slow it down, you know?
Yeah. And so on that note, there's an expansion planned to have the option of going back up to 6 players, but with very specific components designed to speed it up in a 5 to 6 player game that would make it too fast if it were just 2 to 4 players.
Hmm. Yeah. So, I mean, that all depends on the game.
Sure.
I was going to ask, what were some of the earlier influences, Mike, if you want to take this one, to what you think makes a good board game? Like, what do you draw on from your childhood or something like
that? Yahtzee. Well, I'm going to answer this, and I imagine Grant's answer will cross over probably at least 50%. Uh-huh. I'm very much in the designing game mechanics really just came from having an interest in them. But as for inspiration and keeping my imagination active, I'm very much a lover of fairy tales, of Tolkien, C.S. Lewis, and the science fiction side, you know, Star Trek, you know, Star Wars. I was always reading or studying or gaming in those worlds when I was younger.
Okay.
Yeah, and obviously making a board game puts you in those situations and let you be the captain of a ship and, and let you do all that. And I'm the same way. It's, to me, it's like, you know, all the wonderful things that kind of are escapist type things, like fantasy, science fiction. That's what people love. It's fun. You know, if you, I'm not so attracted to a game that's about, you know, managing my taxes. Like, that's not,
that's not fun. And some people are. There's games like Acquire and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. And but our passion really, and like I said, I made a best-selling game on skateboarding.
Yeah.
And I enjoyed the project, but it's not my particular passion.
Yeah.
I want that fantasy and science fiction escapism because I think a lot of people look for that. Just for a few minutes, they're not thinking about their mortgage payment.
What about skateboarding while doing taxes?
Yeah. we grew up playing D&D, Pathfinder,
classics.
All these great RPGs, and of course Zelda and Star Fox,
Pilot Wings.
You know, all these great classic games, and we want to have this same quality in the board game world because, you know, I've got 3 kids, Mike has 1, and, you know, I play video games with my kids, but there's something magical that happens when you sit down for an hour with your family and just play a board game. And the game, once you buy it, it's there and it's different every time, you know? You don't have to pay for it again next time you play it. And it's just, there's something great about it. And that's why we make our games shorter. We love the long games, but you know, for a family or friends, you know, you don't necessarily want to get together like, hey kids, let's play for 4 hours straight.
Put your iPad down. And so I was going to say, or ask you, how do you think games have changed overall in the last, say, 20 years or whatever? And do you think, what effect has have video games had on board games?
The kids' attention span? Yeah.
I think video games for a while, I think the generation that Grant and I are from, you know, original Nintendo, Super Nintendo era, I think that had a very positive effect on the imaginations of our generation. And then I think there was almost this gap where we were all growing up and becoming adults and figuring stuff out, where video games and board games went through a phase where only the really introverted played them.
Yeah.
And then once our generation kind of
had control
and got behind the reins, I think video games and board games have come kind of full circle, where they are can be a positive contributing factor to our culture.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the things that I noticed in the video game world was that games were fun and awesome, and then they got like almost too focused on how it looked instead of and that's when I kind of was like, you know what, I need to back off a little bit. And that's why I'm big fans of Nintendo. They've kind of followed the fun, they're amazing, beautiful games out there that it's kind of gotten over that hump. I think they're still beautiful, but the story is rich, the characters are rich. Mm-hmm. It's awesome. And we, you know, the same thing has happened in the board game world, where it's got, you know, it was all about just making it beautiful, but the games were hollow, and then they've come around full circle. So it's interesting how they parallel in my mind.
Yeah, because you have people, most people I know, at least, like, I'm more of a board gamer, less of a video gamer myself, but I find that the video games I'm attracted to evoke the same emotional response as the board games I'm attracted to. So I think you're going to find that.
Yeah, I don't think in making board games we're trying to compete with video games at all. In fact, that's not how it works in our house at all. You know, I think the video game generation is great. It gets kids to think outside the box. It inspires them. It's fun. It's social. And, you know, board games does it the same way, does the same thing, but in a very different way. Well, you know, sometimes our kids are like, let's sit down and play X-Wing, which is an amazing board game, you know, or sometimes we want to sit and play Journey.
Yeah.
Well, a great example was our families went to Ireland a few years ago, and I was with one of Grant's sons, and we're driving through this area, and he goes, "Wow, this place looks like the Arathi Highlands in World of Warcraft." And I'm like, no, the Arathi Highlands looks like Ireland. And then he goes, "Yeah, but there's no velociraptors here." I'm like, "That's true, but the thing is, after that, he really started asking questions about like he was really looking at the terrain, the flowers, the rocks, the history, which in Ireland is everywhere. And so I think spawning that creativity, whether it's in a video game or a tabletop game, is huge.
Yeah. And we can go on all day about it. Sorry.
Yeah. Oh no. You mentioned how video games, and then it sounds like board games as well, kind of go through this span of where the graphics kind of take over and it detracts from the storyline. I'm curious what your guys' opinion are on the tools and the technology in order to create the art kind of has just exploded over the past few years, especially. Do you think that's had an impact on why that is and why the graphics have kind of taken over? Because it's like, oh, well, now we can do all this really cool, beautiful-looking stuff, but, oh, well, we still have a budget, so we still have to take – it has to come from somewhere.
I think it was the games were fun, but the graphics were weak. And once the ability to make the graphics better, all of a sudden everyone was pioneering that. And so they were eager to show that they had accomplished something and weren't so focused on the story. And now the tools, I'm not going to say it's easy, but the tools are much more usable now in video games to actually create these worlds. And so it's not such – I'm going to get kicked for this, but it's not such an achievement – to make a game beautiful, because the tools are there before you had to invent them. I mean, people are still inventing them, you know what I mean?
Sure, but, yeah.
But there's time now to focus on the story because making it look beautiful is a little more streamlined, is the way I should put it.
Well, and also the processing power has only, it caps out at an eventual point. Yeah. I mean, we can go on the PS4 and see something that's almost photorealistic.
Yeah.
But now it's becoming more like, okay, we all know what photorealistic looks like, but I can do this game and make it this watercolor brush strokes and evoke these feelings. Yeah. And so.
Well, that's it. Like, if I want to look at a real mountain, I'll go look at a real mountain. Like let's make something. If you have this freedom with art, make it amazing. And that's why I get drawn to games like Journey and stuff, where it's not photorealistic, but artistically, it's just wonderful.
Yeah. So what are some of the tools that you use to create your games?
We love Adobe.
Yeah, I work a lot in InDesign. Grant works a lot in Illustrator.
I use Illustrator and Photoshop. First tool is always pen and pencil and paper, and then scan it and kick butt with it. But I use Illustrator for a lot of a combination, the overlap from Photoshop.
From a mechanic side, eventually I'm in InDesign and stuff like that. But my stuff starts with, I have something called a wipe book, mm-hmm. and it's a wet erase book, but like it's a book of little wet erase boards.
Yeah, it's awesome.
And it's one of the best things I've ever had for designing mechanics, because rather than just going to the next page, I can erase what doesn't work and add in a different color, my new mechanic ideas, and it's been invaluable for just core mechanics.
Yeah, you can bring it with you too.
That helps.
I'm sorry, were you gonna say something?
No, go ahead.
I was just curious because I know you guys use digital tutors, but we don't really have any courses on specifically making board games. So I'm just curious, like how have you used, not to make it seem too much like a promo, but I'm just curious to see kind of how you use our tutorials in order to help create your board games.
Yeah, that's not a plug at all. We're not shy. We love digital tutors. Use it all the time, both in board games and video games and all sorts of design. So we use it all the time. I learned how, like anytime I'll have a vision of what I want to do artistically, you know, for the cards, the board, whatever, I will go to Digital Tutors, look it up and see, you know, how the heck do I do this? And sure enough, it's there. It's quick. It's clear. I mean, it's been an invaluable tool. I get emails from you guys all the time. It's always something in it that piques my interest. And I do more than art. You know, I do art, logo design. I do video editing. I do music, you know. And so everything up there is invaluable. And, you know, obviously there's nothing on board game, but there's – it's all about print, you know, it's about how do I make this look beautiful?
Mm, yeah.
And, you know, and from Mike's standpoint, it's layout. You know?
Yeah. It's all InDesign stuff. I need to make some quick gears, and they don't have to be perfect gears because it's not actually part of a machine. So I'm like, all right, I suppose I could, there's always like 8 ways to do something in InDesign, but but it's not necessarily the best way. Right. So I may have done something that took me a half hour, and then I'll go on and see a little tutorial. I'm like, I could have done that in 2 minutes. Yeah. So next time I can do it in 2 minutes and move on and get something done better.
But no, I appreciate the 2 minutes because you've done it the hard way.
Yeah, I was just dinking around on your site, and I saw this tutorial and the technique. Like once I figured it out, I was like, oh my gosh. And I called my wife down. I'm like, watch this. And she's like, yeah, what about it? I'm like, Mike, check this out. And he's like, what about it? I'm like, no, you don't understand. This took me 10 times as long before. And now, you know, now I can do all this art. And like, and sure enough, the next project came. And I did all this art in like less than a week, which would have taken me a month before. And it was like, boom.
Well, that happens with layout, too. It's like there are times I've gone. I'm like, okay, honey, I'm going into the cave to lay out the next game. And I do it. And then I learned some shortcuts through you guys and whatnot. And, you know, I'll do the next game and I'll come out just like an hour or two later. And my wife's like, what's up? I'm like, I'm finished. She goes, you are? I'm like, crud, I could have just stayed in there for the next 8 hours. And she wouldn't have known. Still working, honey. Put the bread and water under the door.
Example, our game Dwarven Miner. It's a lot of heavy artwork. Mike called me up and he goes, hey, we need a cover design, you know, for the distributors so they can market this thing, let people know it's coming. I'm like, okay, sure. you know, we'll just do something and, you know, we'll see.
I felt bad. It wasn't my fault, though.
So I added it to the list. I'm like, when do you need it? He's like, well, tomorrow.
Actually, it was yesterday. I got the email. Like, we got some people interested. Can we have your cover? I'm like,
Yeah, so tomorrow. He was gracious enough to give me tomorrow. So I kissed my wife and closed the door and drew. And I was just intent on doing something, you know, just a placeholder. But again, I was like, I got to buy some time. And so I took some time, got on Digital Tutors, learned a few things. And it was like, boom, and made this cover really quick. And we actually ended up keeping it because it looked good enough.
Yeah, he sent it over to me. I had one minor change, which literally took him about a minute and a half just for my critique. And that was the cover that's on the box today.
Thank you, Digital Tutors.
Digital Tutors work for me.
Well, that's really flattering to hear that we're actually influencing the design of your games and stuff. I also love the fact that
I can't imagine you guys get to hear too much of that. But like I said, the video game company, the guys are always using it. So you're helping make the world a better place and a simpler place.
I also appreciate the fact that you apparently have to like get your wife's opinion on everything like I do.
Don't we all? I mean, isn't that?
It's like the women that we live with so long are so unimpressed with anything we do that we think if we can get that's pretty good, we know that it's like gold.
They know that if they say, yeah, that's good, that you're going to ask them another 17 times to say that's good. Right. So they're very judicious.
Well, the thing is, we all know that, you know, Grant's the artist, and my wife needed business cards a couple of months ago, and she's like, I need business cards. I said, I can whip up something for you. She goes, yeah.
It's got Grant, dragons on it.
Well, I think I mentioned it to you, Grant, but it was actually, then through my wife that made the connection to initially reach out to you. So I think it kind of comes full circle, it sounds like.
I had the wives on.
We should have just had our wives talk instead.
Is he always bothering you? He's down in the basement.
Be a whole different podcast.
Yeah. How has Digital Tutors helped your Pinterest wall?
Don't go there, Digital Tutors. Stay true. Oh, yeah.
Well, guys, we really appreciate you coming on. This has been entertaining.
It's been a blast.
Yeah, we'll have to do it again sometime.
Yeah, man, thank you. It's been a pleasure and an honor, and hopefully we get to do it again.
Mm-hmm. For sure.
Yeah, I know you've given our listeners a lot to think about, and good luck in the future.
Yeah.
All right, you too.
All right. Bye. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, it was Grant Wilson and Mike Ritchie. They're a lot of fun, aren't they?
Oh, yeah, that was a blast. In case you couldn't tell, we had a great time talking to them.
I thought that was so funny. They keep talking about their wives. It reminds me of my own marriage.
Yep, that's, I think anybody who's married and has a, basically goes into your cave and to do work, kind of familiar with that. That's the life of an artist, huh?
Yeah. I hope that what people get out of this episode will be, you know, if they are gamers or they're, you know, into designing them video games, that they can come away with some insights into how they can apply some of this advice and tips that these guys have to their own workflow. Because in the end, you know, you're basically building the same thing with a different medium, I think, in a lot of ways. Yeah. Especially with trying to create an experience through narrative or trying to get people to be specific characters, and you want them to live those characters or something like that. There's probably a lot of crossover as far as technique goes and approach. So hopefully, you know, you game designers out there got something from that.
Yeah. No, as you mentioned that, I think of something. It's I almost see, you know, these days VR is a huge thing, right? And what is VR but the ability to immerse yourself, in that case, in something digital. But I think board games have had and continue to have, and are kind of making a resurgence, at least from what I've seen. They've had that immersion through just the experience that you have with the other people. And that's one of the huge things that draws people to board games is, as Grant had said, and the social aspect,
yeah.
You know, and both Grant and Mike really put all of that into their games to yeah. make sure you have that, because it's that experience, it's that immersion in mm-hmm. in the experience. And so when you're creating, whether it be a board game or if you're creating a video game or whatever that is, what is the end result? But mm-hmm. trying to build an experience that people feel immersed in mm-hmm. and have a good time, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's the end result that you want is the same. The way that you get there may be different,
sure.
if that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great distinction that you made there. The difference between what is immersion. I mean, we use that word all the time, yeah. but it can mean several different things.
Sure.
Most of the time we take it to mean, okay, I'm like in VR, for example, I'm going to make it to where you're so immersed that you can't tell the difference between reality and what you're doing right now,
yeah,
interacting
yeah.
with this game. But of course, that's only a small part of it, because
right.
immersion could be, just like I said a while ago, you're so into the story, or
yeah.
you're so into being the character, just playing, say, a card game,
right,
that you've completely, you've bought in
yeah.
to it. Right?
It almost is your reality. It's not like you're trying to pretend it is
sure.
your reality, but it is. It's
yeah.
it's become that way in your mind. Yeah.
Yeah. And another way that we do that all the time through story, you know,
oh, yeah.
movies
all
do
the
that
time.
All the time. They suck you in. But the other way is to create a social experience, which can work exactly the same way.
Yep.
We've all had experiences
oh, yeah.
where we're with friends and we're doing something like playing a game or
mm-hmm.
whatever,
yeah.
something illegal. No, but it's the social aspect of it to where you completely are together
yeah.
in that moment.
Yeah.
And it's creating those moments in whatever way you can do that,
uh-huh.
that I think is what true immersion is. We get,
yeah.
I just think sometimes we get stuck on visual fidelity
yeah.
as
oh,
being
yeah.
what that means.
Uh-huh.
And it excludes so much of that other stuff.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
To the detriment of the medium itself, I think.
Oh, no, I certainly agree. I think you're right. I think something that, with you know the visual side that you talked mm-hmm. about, we talked about that in the interview as well, but that is every time there's new technology around that, and I think that's kind of why I mentioned VR, because it's a big thing right now, right?
Yeah.
It's new technology, and what is VR, but really it's kind of a visual. I mean, you have the audio side too, but
sure.
it's another visual form, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so that's kind of the big thing right now, is the visual side. Kind of like before it was, oh, we have this technology now where we can, I think it was Mike
sure.
that talked about, you know, oh, the PS4 can do photorealistic graphics. Okay,
yeah.
well, then that's kind of the big thing, right, is to
right.
be able to create that. And not saying there's anything wrong with creating that, but kind of like they alluded to, you don't want to make the story suffer
mm-hmm.
Or make that immersion from that's outside of the visual aspect suffer because you're putting this in.
Too much attention to it, I think, is what has happened
yeah.
In the past.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
you can do it, because you can make it look this way. You can take the visual to
right.
another extreme, that's what you focus on to the detriment of the story. And that's
yeah.
what they were complaining about. I completely agree with that.
Oh, yeah.
It's probably a cyclical thing.
Oh, I'm sure
where,
it is.
Like you said, it's spawned by a particular technology.
Uh-huh.
And then we push that as far
see
as
far we
can
mm-hmm.
until people go, you know, this is really pretty, but I don't give a shit about this.
Yeah.
In the end, I can sit here and look at it. And it always comes back to story.
Yeah.
To make people, to really immerse them
mm-hmm.
into it, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's sort of like, I mean, one of the reasons I think that visual is so pushed
mm-hmm.
is because, especially in VR, is because VR is visual.
Yeah.
Right? It's a first-person perspective
sure.
as if you're looking through
yeah.
well, your own eyes,
yeah.
or if you're trying to play a character, that character's eyes.
Right.
As opposed to a third person.
Right.
Watching other people, sort
yeah.
of.
Yeah. Yeah. I think something that I found really unique, kind of along those lines with, as far as board games are concerned,
mm-hmm.
Is that it's not really, you're pushing that story, right?
Mm-hmm.
But you're also creating a story. So, a
yeah.
lot of times with video games, I
sure.
mean, there's multiplayer games, right? But even a lot of multiplayer games, you're playing that by yourself online, right?
Sure.
I mean, there's party games. That's kind of an exception. But board games, once again, there's single-player board games.
Sure.
Or,
yeah.
Tabletop games, solitaire, right? but it's – you have a story in the game itself, But a huge part of it is creating the story or creating the moments, you know, with your family or with your friends of a story that you're going to tell later.
Right.
Right. And the game is the way that you do that. And I think that's a huge, huge benefit that board games have. And I'd say I'd put myself out there to say even more so than most video games these days.
Yeah.
Just because most video games, with the exception of some party games, are so they're a solo experience, right? I mean, you have that experience by yourself, with other people in a virtual world, perhaps for online multiplayer, but you're still by yourself having that experience. Physically. Yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, there's some of the most popular games in the world are those huge multiplayer online, massive multiplayer online, right? And people still seek out the social in it.
Oh yeah,
regardless.
Oh yeah.
So
yeah, but it's a different type of social experience, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. And it's something where, I mean, I'm sure some people have, but I don't know anybody, and I know a lot of people that have played those huge MMOs right online. World of Warcraft or that type of game, but I don't know of any where they're like, oh, do you remember that one time when we did this one thing, as far as, you know, the social side? Whereas when you're playing a board game, sitting around with your family or friends, the next day it's, oh, you remember when we did that? You know, I mean, it's that you're building that moment that I think is, there's just something special about that.
I think that they can create those experiences. In a virtual world, because I've heard people talk about that. You remember when we took over that group of orcs and this happened, and I think it's still possible. And I absolutely
agree.
It's
a lot harder to do.
Yeah, I agree that it is a lot harder to do. I absolutely agree that that a board game, what it does is create the story.
Yeah.
As it's going, and that you recount that story later on, right, with your friends, remember this.
Yeah,
that's really the narrative.
Yeah,
that's being,
because you're a lot more involved in it as opposed to playing through somebody else's story. You're somewhat playing through someone else's story, but you're also helping to create that through the social experience
as well. You're a part of it.
Yeah,
of creating.
Yeah, exactly.
Mm. This got deep.
It's real meta.
If you've got any questions, comments, or suggestions for future episodes, please reach out to us at our Facebook and Twitter pages.
Or you can find us on the Digital Tutors blog at blog.digitaltutors.com, and we'll be sure to put all of those links in the show notes. Thanks for listening.